This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's Charlie James of the Charlie James Gallery in Chinatown is our guest today. He is going to knock your socks off, especially if you're an abstract painter. There's so many things that I want to tell you, though, before we get to that. Here's an interesting bit of analytical oddness, if you will. I'm always perplexed, honestly, by the popularity of a given episode on this show, and a recent case in point is Christian Viveros Fonet, the art critic, among other things, of The Village Voice, a very recent episode, is very popular, and that episode has eclipsed in downloads the Jerry Saltz, celebrity art critic Jerry Saltz episode from three or four episodes prior to that. And he just went and passed him right up. And Jerry Saltz has this tremendous social media presence. Christian has essentially no social media presence. So I take it the way to explain that is that this is still a word of mouth podcast as much, if not more, than social media. Does that sound about right to you? Just wanted to put that out there. Some other things on my mind are, there is a show up currently at Cal State LA in Los Angeles, one of the Cal State schools, obviously, of a painter named Robert Olson. And I was sort of looking into that show, and I found out, to my surprise, that Robert Olson passed away over 6 months ago. There was a LA Times obituary, and he was 44, I believe, and you know, it just gets you to thinking when an artist dies on the younger side, and you don't hear about it until sort of this weird set of serendipitous events or just doing a little research, you find out about it well after the fact. I mean, first of all, I guess if you went to school with him, that would be a big difference. That's been an experience of mine in the past that I found out that somebody passed young. Did you know about this? Are you aware of his work? I think the biggest question that this brings up is, for me, we don't really talk much, first of all, we don't really talk much about the mortality issue of artists. It's a subject for anybody, but it's rarely come up on this show, very rarely, and it's been brief when it's been mentioned. I guess the thing that probably occurs to most people who are listening to this, who are artists, is when they learn of a premature death of an artist, they wonder, you know, who is going to know about me when I die? Am I going to get an obituary in the LA Times? You know, he had made a name for himself. He had shown regularly at Suzanne Vielmetter Gallery. And all that to say, you know, if it's still up, try to go check out that show at Cal State LA for his memory, I suppose, if nothing else. I haven't seen it yet, but I plan to. Before we now finally, that having been said, now that we are going to the conversation with Charlie James, I just want to let you know that we recorded this on the third anniversary of the launch of the podcast. And I was greeted with a nonplussed response, let's say, from, as you will hear, from my two collaborators, and I just wanted to let you know about it. Maybe you have some ideas of what we can do. Actually, we are just a couple episodes away from the 100th episode, finally, so that's going to be 100 episodes in about 3 years, 33 year, not too bad. We can pick up the pace for sure, but I don't know, what are you looking for in a 100th episode? What do you recommend in a 100th episode celebration? A medley of greatest hits, just a really good episode, or me yammering for 10 minutes about the history of the show and my experience? You know, what? Any of those things or none of the above? Let us know what you think through theconversationpod.com, social media, and so on. All right. Thank you very much for being here. I think you're going to get a kick out of this conversation. Oh, one more thing. Charlie did use the word filibuster when referring to this conversation that we had in that he kind of filibustered things a bit. But, you know, when I listen back to it, it didn't really bother me at all. So I think it was more in the moment, but you're going to enjoy this. So let's get to it now without further blabbering from me. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end with some important news about the show. This is The Conversation, and before I introduce who I'm talking to, I just want to say that this happens to be the day of 3 years since this podcast launched, so not a mean feat. Anyway, that having been gotten out of the way, I am joined by longtime guest host Margie Schnibbe. Hello, Margie.
Hi, Michael.
And we are joined by Charlie James of Charlie James Gallery in Chinatown, and we are actually up in the crow's nest of the Charlie James Gallery on Chungking Road. Hello, Charlie.
Welcome, you guys. Thanks for being
Charlie.
Here.
And I think no better place to start is that you are on Chungking Road in Chinatown. And I guess I want to know what your history with Chinatown is. And I'll just set this up by saying I first came to L.A. in 2001 and shortly thereafter came to, a night of openings on Chungking Road, and it was like that was around the heyday.
Yeah. Well, there's several heydays.
Okay.
We might be, depending on how people assess it, like the third generation of Chinatown galleries.
Right. Right.
Because there were some in the late '90s and in the early '00s, and then there was the vaunted second generation, as I call it, with Javier Perez and Dan Hoog and Kordansky and Joel Messler and all these Nick Adim and all these pretty awesome people. Many of which who have graduated to substantial things. We're in the original Perez project space, which I'm actually quite proud of, actually.
Right, uh-huh.
So like important Dash Snow, Dash Snow had guys jerking off, like in the space, and Terrence Coe filled the basement with flower and birds. Like some kind of heavy contemporary shows happened in this building. So
right, right.
Yeah, so I think, depending on how you think about it, we're probably the third generation here on Chungking Road. I'm proud to be here. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. And well, what is, I guess the subtext of that question also, or intro, is what kind of, atmosphere is there when there's an opening night these days?
It's good.
Yeah?
It's good still. Yeah. So I'm going to have to, we'll have to be careful about run on here, but that's a big question, right? So Chinatown isn't what it was in that second generation or I'm less familiar with the first, but what I just called the second generation, that was heavy. And we have consistently for years, I think, suffered by comparison to that second generation who have kind of evolved, or some people closed, but a lot of them evolved. But as I see it, Chinatown is a fundamental good. And I think most people in LA on the art scene recognize Chinatown as a fundamental good. It's inherently good. It's a private road. There are no cops. There's basically no rules. It's charming. It's accommodating. It's easy to park. It's cheap. There's things to do afterwards. So the energy is still good. People still like to come down here, and we still get focused traffic down here. I can get, curators from museums. The press still come. If the press didn't come, that would be a big time bummer.
Yeah.
But they come, and we're pleased about that. But Michael, I guess this is going to sprawl into a different point, but I think it's an important one. My assessment of LA right now from a gallery perspective is that the supply of galleries and good galleries is growing far faster than the demand, meaning the collector base or what have you.
Yeah.
And it's growing in a kind of without pattern with respect to geography, right? So you have, these guys have colonized what I would call the asshole of Hollywood, right? Like Santa Monica and Highland. That's known for black transvestites and public storage facilities. Steve McQueen Square. I always thought it was hilarious that Santa Monica and Highland is like the worst intersection in Hollywood. It's Steve McQueen Square. He was a hero of mine. Anyway, you have lots of really good galleries clustered around this place.
Right? Are you the one to coin the asshole of Hollywood, or is that already out there?
I mean, that's just an honest assessment. I'm not. I don't think anyone would doubt it, right?
I mean,
you have these excellent galleries hard up against Walgreens and envious Sucambio places and Donut Kings and stuff. It is kind of, and there's three public stores. I know that block pretty good, actually.
Okay.
So when you talk about the conditions in Chinatown, you've got, the fundamental problem with LA is geography and distance and travel, right? And I'm the worst at it. Like if there's an opening in Westwood, at 7 o'clock, like the chances are like 8% that I'm going to make. And with an increasing supply of galleries in a wacky geographic distribution, it's going to, I think, the Charlie James assessment is that it's going to kind of reduce traffic, general milling around traffic writ large across the landscape. But it's a good time in LA, right? I mean, it's all this energy. We have big out-of-towners come in. People are relocating. We're known for this heavy, heavy cache of artists that we have. It's all true. But it's, you know, from a brick-and-mortar perspective in LA, net-net, Michael, my point being, I think I'm coming to the close of it, is that to me, you know, low overhead in a cute neighborhood with a perfect space in Chinatown is A-OK, because there are way too many places to go. I just don't know if doubling my overhead to go to Hollywood or Culver City, which some people say is diminished.
Right.
We know it's held up by pillars that aren't going anywhere, so it's only so diminished. But you hear this a lot, right? It's all this goofy, dumb talk.
Well, people always want to know, where's the next place?
Yeah. You know? And anyway, and I personally feel like the dumbest person in the world when I improve someone else's space. Like, this is not a good feeling. You know you're on the wrong side of the economic spectrum when you're perfecting somebody else's property. And I've done it twice. And although this one didn't require that much, but it's a, you feel like a jackass doing that. So in some ways, what you're hearing might be a rationalization for not moving, but I believe that it might be somehow based on elements of logic. Anyway, that's what
Well, you've got a great spot here. And I mean, I've been to openings here when there were other openings in Chinatown and when just you had an opening. And there's always a good amount of people who come.
Openings are still good. It's true. Day-to-day traffic, I'd say it's pretty light. But again, focus traffic is what you need.
Well, I wanted to interject with the fact that I heard from somewhere that it's kind of a bit of a non-issue that you're in Chinatown because you do a fair amount of selling remotely.
Oh, that's absolutely right,
Michael. Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's exactly right. And that's the way it's always been. So
for you.
Yeah. So, and I didn't quite fully, I kind of went left on you with your question because it's a rich question, but you started coming to Chinatown in 01. I started to parachute into LA 3-4 times a year and I'd come to Chinatown.
From where?
From Seattle. I was up in Seattle and my uncle was in Monterey. He's now moved to LA and we'd come and we'd parachute down into LA. We'd always hit Chinatown.
I like that image, you know, like parachuting into town.
Like 04, 05, 06. And then I was working at Microsoft and I was dead sick of it. And I, you know, anyway, in 08, I moved down and opened the gallery in like November of 2008, which was like right after banks were closed. Like as banks were closing, we opened the gallery,
right?
With knowing like 5 people in LA, no one should do this, but no one.
Well, let's not gloss over Microsoft. So is your background in technology?
Well, my educational background was in, I was an English major. I was in grad school for literary theory and stuff. And it was just this weird time where I took this kind of jackass job. The beginnings of outsourcing used to go to Denver. Before they went to the Philippines and India, they used to go to Denver. And I was in Denver at the time. And I took one of these headset jobs, where I would literally like, thanks for calling, you know, I don't work for the company I say I work for. How are you today? And I'd read my books and I'd, you know, sit around and lament my status. And anyway, the company just went crazy. And it ended up becoming this accidental 12-year career that ended up with a 5-year stint at Microsoft. It was good.
So the small company fed into Microsoft?
Yeah, it wasn't that small, but it was like a $1 billion company ultimately. But and then there was some consulting. It was a good run, but you know, it's one of these things. It's a bit of a luxurious position. You know, I was heading into my late 30s, and you know that whole ambition thing, the whole blind ambition starts to burn off after 35, and you start to look around. You know, for a while I felt like I was playing catch up. I needed to make money. I was doing all this stuff, and then after 35, though, you're kind of like, okay, well, what am I doing? You know what I mean? And it's a bit, like I said, I know this to be kind of a luxurious position, but you start to wonder, like, what is the work of my life? You know what I mean? Some people can't afford to worry about that, right? But I could. And, I consider my fundamental, I guess, orientation to be toward the arts. And so I live on them. You know, I can't exist without them. And so I wanted to go back to that. And
how were you living on the arts when you were up in Seattle?
Well, you know, what woke me back up again was collecting. So I was a modest collector, but it was a really, really powerful experience. What people have to remember about collecting is all this talk about speculation these days, right? Everyone's wanting to flip and make money and all these hot artists. It's a hot market. You hear a lot about speculation, but the fundamental hook about collecting is that it's a proxy form of creativity for collectors. Their collection is there. They're expressing themselves by the acquisition of Margie's piece and your piece and my piece or whatever.
Well, that's like a true collector and the kind of collector an artist wants.
I think it's there all the time, right? Yeah. And then, you know, and for me, it was just the best thing. Like, you know, doing studio visits, I knew exactly how to talk to them. I knew what they were talking about. I'd studied aesthetic theory. You know, I had a bias toward work that was kind of, that had levels of kind of conceptual meaning that were available for interpretation. Never a big abstraction guy, as you can see by looking around.
What were you starting to collect at the beginning?
Mostly West Coast. I had a bunch of Sandow Burke work. Sandow Burke's kind of an LA hero, you know, from the beaches south of LA. I really connected with his work. I bought a Ruscha print, you know, back in the day. But so mostly California stuff.
So you would be living up in Seattle. You would come down for a weekend and
that's
you would
right.
go around.
That's right.
And then eventually you started doing studio visits.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I worked with a good gallery, actually a Bay Area gallery that kind of, you know, plugged me generously into studio business. And that was, you know, that the hook just gets set, you know, because these artists, you know, and it happened that the artists that I was meeting with were generous. They were interesting. They were kind of academically biased. So I could talk, you know, like I felt. It was like a hand in glove fit talking to them.
Right.
And the whole thing where it really kind of woke me up, like it was a big deal. And I was like, fuck, you know, this is great. You know,
what am I doing working at Microsoft?
Right. This is, I'm wank, you know, this is a wank, you know, and I'm losing time. I'm crowding 40. So, you know, while still in my years of initiative, I decided to, you know, open the gallery. And there was a real critical relationship along the way. There was an artist who was up in Seattle with his, girlfriend, wife, and I would take my stuff to be framed with him. And he was, you know, I'm not a blank page kind of guy. So I'm like, how should I do this? Anyway, we ended up working together really well. He moved down here. He helped me immeasurably with setting up the gallery, understanding how to put together a good show. And, you know, I was a pretty quick study and we worked real well together. So starting in Chinatown as the bottom fell out of the market, that's my story, right? But there can be advantages to starting when the market has gone straight to hell. I know this. You know, we got into art fairs we wouldn't have ordinarily gotten into because there were fewer of them, mm-hmm. and they were covetous of resources, you know, money. And we had access to artists. You know, some galleries, particularly New York, which is famous for this, unfortunately, I couldn't pay their artists. So I was able to represent good mid-career New York and other and Bay Area artists out of the gate without, you know, without any kind of commission bullshit.
Right.
So there were advantages and we were funded to basically not make money for a while, which, as it happens, was good because, you know. Anyway, it's weird. I kind of, you know, you hear about this. I don't know if the new generation will understand, but there's always those old stories like the beginning. I used to walk 5 miles to school, that kind of shit. You know, these your grandparents that grew up in the Depression, you know, stretching a dollar. Well, that's kind of how I am with the art world, right? I came up when the market was fucked, you know, so I kind of don't know any better. And the art fairs really kind of allowed us to continue.
Right.
Yeah.
What did you mean when you said you were being funded as you were starting into things?
Well, I had enough money to grow the business.
Yeah. So the royal we was funding ourselves.
Yes, me. Right.
But that's how you build. That's a proper way to build a gallery. Is you have to just believe in your artists and ride out those first few years.
It's true.
I mean,
it took us basically five. Now we made appreciable amounts of revenue. Every year, and every year was like 35% better, like in those first 2, 3, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of this business is so expensive, particularly when you rely from a collector acquisition perspective on art fairs, because even in 08, 09, people would still, you know, the traffic coming to Chinatown was still richer, and I was still making meaningful relationships with buyers just being here.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you know, we've always had good luck with the press, parenthetically. Like, the LA Times has been good to us. Something like close to half of our solo shows have been covered in the LA Times. It's one of the things I'm most proud of and thankful for. But even with that early and consistent kind of press presence, it didn't translate. It translated in some dollars, but not, like, so much that, like, like without the art fairs, I would have closed in like 18 months for sure. If it was only a matter of being here and doing the very best that you could, it would not work. Period. Not mm-hmm. work. Coming from a position of not having a collector base, it wouldn't work at all. So the, you know, the art fairs are you know, I'm actually kind of, I'm a qualified proponent of art fairs. It's the only reason that the gallery works.
So what percentage you, I mentioned earlier
out of town
heard
versus local.
About your
80-20 out of town.
But I think more specifically, what about sales that are just through, I mean, are there actual sales that are just from online? People haven't even seen the work at an art fair.
Oh yeah. That 80-20. Yeah. Yeah. I pictures, man. I sell off pictures.
So how do people find you then?
Well,
like if it's somebody who hasn't been in LA to Chinatown and they found one of your artists.
Well, we've been doing like, no lie, like 7 or 8 art fairs a year for almost 6 years. So we've met and retained, you know, when you meet people, you know, when someone buys something, it's a bonding experience. It's easy to want to hug them and for them to want to hug you. Everyone's excited. Everyone feels good. And that has been, we've been good at keeping and growing relationships, you know, keeping people posted when good things happen to the artists that they've, you know, invested in, you know, having them come to the gallery when they're in LA, you know, all that stuff. That's essential. That is absolutely has to happen. You know, so we've found a number of people doing 8 art fairs a year for 6 years. I mean, we have collectors now. And we also use other vehicles. We use Artsy, which is this kind of gussied up, you know, ArtNet kind of a thing. It's like ArtNet Plus. It's better than ArtNet. I don't want to, I want to qualify immediately. It has a juiced in board, like Dasha Zukova's on the board, and all these, you know, these kind of plutocratic art world figures are funding the thing. Mm-hmm. And there really are good people working there. Like the salespeople that kind of work with us on finding clients for the work are super awesome. Anyway, blah, blah,
what's,
blah.
What's the procedure for getting into that system?
That's a good question. I got in initially into like a pilot based on relationships. Like I met them somehow. And there was like a mutual kind of, hey, cool, right? Yeah, you know, I'd love to be a part of the pilot or whatever. And so then I was just on it for a while. And then they actually started charging you to be on it, which I was sad to see that day come, but you know, what are you gonna do? And I opted to stay because, you know, it's, we're accessing, you know, the right kind of people and across, you know, cool verticals like luxury goods, people who own badass shoe lines and stuff like that, you know, and you know, the kind of people that you kind of want, and they're across a pretty significant geography. So I don't want this to be a plug. I want to qualify that gussied up ArtNet. They would not be stoked with me saying that. But it's been good, but that's one of the things that we do. But, yeah. And we work with artists that gin up a lot of energy too, right? Like some of our guys are like dynamic in the social media space. William Pauhida is famous basically, right? I mean, he's a pet project of the New York Times. He's always in social media. His books he's in the new Sarah Thornton book. He has a chapter in the new, you know, and Steve Lambert's always stirring up shit. Like, so we have guys and we look for people, especially as a gallery that was starting from nothing, that could bring their energy into the gallery, right? Where a percentage of it will remain, right? Like, you know, the gallery of course looks to help assist, elevate all the time the artist, but I can make, there's no two ways about it. I mean, the artists made us. I mean, the artists make every gallery, but they definitely helped define who we were. Mm-hmm. And we happen to work with a lot of people that gin up attention all by themselves. And then we push it, and, you know, and anyway, it's work.
What fairs have you been doing over the years?
Oh, gee whiz. We used to do Pulse quite a bit. We still kind of do. We do Expo Chicago in Chicago, which is an armory level fair. That's the best fair that we do. We don't get much love from the NADA people, but that's the kind of a consistent refrain. And I do Dallas. I used to do this goofy art fair in Aspen, but like worked. Like there were so many rich people in the summer in Aspen. Anyway, being in Aspen in August is about the best thing that could possibly happen. But I've done tons of them. I go to San Francisco every year. So we do some of these unfashionable regional art fairs. Like San Francisco, you're not really supposed to do that. Like there's a couple different ways to approach it, right? You can hold out from art fairs and do only the meaningful ones so that you get in this kind of preferential kind of lights or whatever. But I didn't have the option of doing that. We needed revenue. We needed money. We needed collectors. So we went a lot of places. We didn't fucking, you know, we tried not to be in embarrassing presentations, obviously, but mm-hmm. we did some, you know, some middle, you know, we did some regional fairs, and they're solid. I mean, there were some good galleries in there, but by the letter of some laws in the art world, you're not supposed to do them, but I don't fucking care. I mean, we needed the money, we needed, you know, and we still do.
Well, what is the downside that somebody's going to see that you did so-and-so art fair and there's like, judgment?
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Well, there's like a hierarchy of art fairs.
Yeah, they kind of adjudicate, you know, what level you are. So we're at this weird level where we're kind of, we're trying to climb beyond kind of solid, moneyed middle-class fairs like Pulse, you know, maybe a toehold at the Armory level. But, you know, the program is
so what's the next, sorry to interrupt, Charlie, what is the next level? Like, is the, you haven't done the Armory,
no,
for example.
No,
is that something you're applying to?
Absolutely.
And like, if you get into that, that's like, we're at the next level?
That would be good. Yeah,
right. What do you think you need to get into that?
I don't know. I think what we need is, I think we're doing what we need. It's just a matter of like, we're working with artists that are making, you know, big things happen. And it's just a matter of the really quality things happen. Stuff we're very proud of. Stuff that anyone would be proud of. Artists being acquired by the Whitney Museum. And, you know, we've got good, solid, you know, unambiguously good things happening with a number of the artists in the program. And it's just a matter of that getting known, you know, it's just a matter of, I guess, that being known better.
Well, it takes time, maybe. It just takes some time.
I know. We're in our sixth year, so I'm kind of like, all right, you know? Fucking, you know, let's get the show on the road. But I know that 6 years isn't that long, but it feels...
It is and long. It isn't.
It is and it is. Yeah, it's a long... Yeah.
A lot of galleries have closed, you know, with a lot fewer years.
That's true.
Well, if you make it past five, that's really good.
Well, that was the tipping point for us. It was, you know, at the end of 5 years, again, we'd done better every year. We were doing, you know... real revenue, not like, you know, hopeless bullshit stuff. But it, you know, in terms of like it had to ramp up, or I might've had to think about, well, how do I alter the model a little bit? You know what I mean? Like I might've had to start thinking about how do I take this apart or alter it, you know, become one of these galleries that just, you know, for a while they go without a space and they show up at art fairs. There are legions of these people. It's like a late stage thing that happens to galleries, right?
Right.
All of a sudden they don't have a space. They don't get a new one, but they still pop up at fairs and they hang out for a little bit longer. That could have been, you know, our reality, but in the 6 year it's bumped up. It's a good time to be doing this. It's not easy. It's never easy, but it's not easy. But there is definitely a robust market out there. And if you've got good work and you know what you're doing, I think that you can sell art right now. Maybe not out of your brick and mortar space, but you can sell it.
Right.
Brick and mortar to me is a funny thing.
Well, let me jump into a related question, which is that it's heartening to me that you have a modest operation in that, I mean, we're here on a Tuesday, which is obviously the slowest day of the week, but you don't have anybody here. I presume what?
Well, we're not open today.
Oh, okay. Are you open Wednesday to Saturday?
Yes.
Okay. Well, how many people do you have, like one person with you usually? Or?
Yeah. Who's here, like, you know, by my side? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have like an assistant who helps me, you know, do admin stuff, shipping stuff. She's kind of an ombudsman, you know, she does anything that I can't or don't want to do. And of course I have preparators and stuff. We have an excellent virtual team, but it is virtual. Yeah. We run lean for sure.
Yeah. So there
it's
you go.
Only
that's,
way.
That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah. We're not burning money. That's for sure. I mean, well, we are these art fairs are ungodly expensive, but that's, if we're burning money, that's the only place we're doing it.
How ungodly expensive are they?
They're horrible. Horrible. They're generally speaking, it's hard to get away with one for less all up with shipping and being there and
staying,
drinking and eating and going back or flying and all the shit. You're lucky if you can do it for under 10. You're really lucky if you can do it for under $10,000.
So you're talking, like, we're talking about the ones that you've done from 10 anywhere up to what, 20 or?
Yeah, generally. I would
for
say
3 days, right?
Yeah. Four, three and a VIP thing.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's great. But again, you know, the fairs have always been good for us. We've always scored. Like, I have it's not a boast. It's just what it is. It's how we made it. there is a meritocratic argument for the art fair. So as like when we kind of got into some of these fairs from scratch, from nowhere, and we did immediately, just based on some people that we knew that were good to us, that like put in a word with Pulse. Like, we shouldn't have gotten into Pulse. Anyway, we got in there, and the thing is that you got people who have been doing this for a long time. And it's kind of like the here's the church, here's the steeple, open up, see all the people. You put your program next to mine, and we've consistently been able to stop people and have the work reward their more, you know, their closer intention, be mellow with them, be nice. That's like, just be fucking nice is kind of our sales strategy. How you doing? You know, how, you know, just let's hang out and then, you know, see what happens. And it's just worked. It's worked from the beginning. Like, there are few art fairs where I know I can count on one hand the number of art fairs where we've actually like taken it on the chin. It normally doesn't happen. And it's just good fortune for us. But, anyway, they're a pain in the ass, though. Like, I'm dead sick of them.
I'm thank you for making that point, because as you've been talking about fairs, you know, intermittently, I wanted to ask you, do you enjoy them? No, it sounds like part of you kind of does. Yeah.
They're a weird and kind of a unhealthy mix of excitement, elation, tedium, and exhaustion.
Yeah, I was going to say exhaustion, because you have to put it up. You're there for days and days and talking to everyone.
For days, you're, you know, total fire hose with, you know, good questions, bad questions, you know, and it's like that cocktail of emotional energy, right? Like expectation, excitement, anxiety, boredom, right? I mean, you know, I'm just sure glad that they serve fucking wine at those things. And that can be kind of bad for you. They're fucking bad for your health. I'm telling you, because it, like for me, like you gotta have a few drinks. You just have to, with that weird kind of vibe. All these fucking people and all this, you know, and then you're tired and blah, blah, you know, it's like easy to get sick. I mean, it's.
And not, then are you and doing the after party as well?
Well, I'm actually pretty chill on the after party thing. Like in Miami, like I would historically just go to the Mocha Vanity Fair party, and then I'd kind of peace out on the parties because I would be fucking tired. Because I run lean, you know, like I might have an assistant. I've done fairs without them. This is not to be, I do not advocate for this. Doing fairs alone, particularly the bigger, that's a bad idea, but I've done them. But yeah, it's.
And when you do have an assistant or, you know, or a coworker or a team with you, do you focus on having that person being a really good extroverted salesperson type of person?
Really nice, smart, mellow, good. Kind of, you know, that's what I, you know, not a salesperson, like not one of these, you know, hatchets that you see. Like some art fairs, you bring them in and these people are like professional, you know, I almost want to say asshole. Yeah, kind of, right? Like they're just like talking to anybody who walks by. Have you ever seen, you know, do you know the work of Joe Blow? Let me tell you about that. That is not what we do. You know what I mean? We just lay back and we're attentive, but it's about, we kind of a do unto others thing, right? Don't fuck, you know, we read energy, watch what they respond to. If they look like they, you know, then we'll engage lightly, you know. Whatever.
But if you have the second person, then you can be sitting back occasionally.
The second person lets me sleep in on Friday morning. You know what I mean? That's what they're for. And basically I only assign them the assignment of like, get me an email dialogue with these people. I don't say you got to sell this shit. You know, I just say, listen, get me in an email conversation with this person and I'm stoked with you. That's what I tell them to do. Get me emails and proofread them and tell me and note who they're inquired about and be here when I don't want to be. And you've done great.
And has this been the assistant that you've been using here?
No, completely different. I had this lovely, lovely woman from Toronto that was just perfect. She was perfect. She was like, you know, kind of a girl next door. She was pretty, but she was, you know, but in a completely accessible, nice way. She was smart. She was, you know, kind and patient and easy energy, no ego, but she was there. I mean, she had a bubbly effervescence to her too. She was dead perfect. And
where did you meet her?
I met her at Art Toronto, which was one of the fairs I couldn't actually get to work. I tried it twice. You know, we did some business there, but not enough to stick around after 2 years. I had to pull the chute. But she was great, and I would bring her down to Miami with me, and she did a great job. Anyway.
Right. What's coming up for you?
Miami.
Okay, yeah. We're in almost mid-November, so we're about a month away.
The work
away.
Will be picked up.
And is she going to be there?
It'll be an assay. I'm actually thinking about flying down one of her friends from Toronto, who she insists, and I believe is basically her. That's kind of what I want. Is like, you know,
a friend of hers who's as good as her.
It was exactly like her. That's what I want. Someone exactly like you. Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah. It doesn't stop really.
This is Pulse, right?
This is Pulse. It's on the beach.
And Miami is the I would have to hazard is the most exhausting there to do, just because there's so much.
Well,
volume.
You have to marshal your energy, right? If you no one should ever get drunk early in the Miami week, because you'll be on your heels. It'll be bad. And I don't know. Pace yourself. But you're talking to somebody that, like, there's somewhat of a disadvantage starting the gallery, like, at 38, you know, I'm 5 years older than that now. Which is, you know, I don't want to, you know, like, yeah, this party starts at 11. I'm like, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, like, I'm not fucking going. It's like, that's how it is, right? Like, it's, you know, I like to do my drinking at between six and 8 o'clock. You know what I mean? So anyway, that kind of keeps me out of some trouble, but it can also be limiting too, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of get your picture taken shit, you know, go to these parties. And I kind of am like, well, yeah, I don't give a fuck.
That's really not going to be helpful.
Well, it just doesn't work for me. It does help. I mean, it, you know, it's all about relationships, right? So anywhere you can make them, make them. But what I'm saying is, and I'm saying it as kind of a shortcoming, but one that can have some positive outcomes, which is I often don't have the energy for the coolest parties. I have energy for like one.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, cool, let's go home.
Well, you need your energy for the day.
You need your energy for the day.
Well, it's great though, because when the collectors and the people come to your booth, they see you, right? So that's a really great thing. And
that's
true. Sense your enthusiasm about the work and the artist, and that's what sells the work, and that's what you're there for.
That's right.
So
that's what
we try. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, it works out okay. It works out okay. But yeah, that's coming up, and we're going to do Zona Mako in Mexico City in February. That's a goddamn expensive art fair. It's good, right? I mean, there's a lot. I was just in Mexico City. One of my artists had a project down there. It was super awesome. Mexico City is fun as hell. You have these weird alternative MFA programs, the SOMA program, which I think is Joshua Ocon is one of the artists that headed this thing up. I met a couple of artists getting their SOMA MFAs that are like hanging out down there. Like, and they were interesting people. They were doing things. I don't know much past that, but the energy in Mexico City was all good. And you have these plutocratic collectors opening museums, the Humex guy, Eugenio Lopez, or I think, and
the richest guy in the world.
The other, that's Slim.
Oh,
he has a different museum, which is less serious.
Right.
It's more oddball than the Humex Museum. But so anyway, I'm excited to go down to Zona Mako. I had so much fun. The eating is amazing, but it's like stupid expensive down there. Like this fair is 15 grand just to be there for a small booth. That to me is a bummer. But and to be honest, you know, I've done and tried to do business in Mexico, and it isn't so easy. Like getting offered like half the list price is like routine down there. For here, that's the mark of either an insensitive or an ignorant collector for them to offer you like half like that. They're either, you know, it's not good, you know, and good collectors would never do that. You know, they may want to end up there somehow. Right. But they wouldn't start there, but it's routine down there for people to offer you. Like,
so what is the draw then?
Well, right. It's a good question. It's good. I mean, it's good. And I think we've got the right context for that fair. I think we've got artists that make sense down there. I think it's attended by an attractive set of international curators and taste. I hate using the word taste maker. I don't know. Just people that you want to meet. I sense that they're there.
Right.
Last year was certainly a big year down there, because I think that's when they opened the Humex Museum. And so everyone went down there for these maniac parties and stuff. It's easy to have fun down there. I'm hoping that we can make some new relationships. The motivation with any art fair, it's of course, at the simplest, it's money, but it's also where you, it's also collector acquisition, new, you know, meeting, you know, getting new curator relationships which are long-term payoffs and medium-term payoffs. So I'm, you know, I'm actually kind of proud even maybe that we're doing, like, I think it's, mm-hmm. it's the right thing for us. It's good context.
Right.
But it's lamely expensive. I can tell you, I may be, you know, just losing a shit ton of money, but we'll see. I'm actually more optimistic than that. Like I think I'm going to be able to show work that they won't be able to resist, but you know, I'd be stoked to straight up break even from a money perspective. I really want to meet you know, quality people down there and make some waves and create some of that awareness at the elite level. Cause I'm taking, you know, a couple of artists that I'm really excited about down there. And back to your question about how, like, how do we make that Armory thing happen? It's about awareness. And I think I'm taking artists that I think can help, who I need that awareness generated for.
Right. Right. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a total ass ache. You know, the way to do this business is to work for Badass Gallery number one for maybe a year or 2 years, then maybe even and go with those relationships to Badass Gallery number two. And then, you know, you have some kind of financial wherewithal, and then you open your own gallery. That's the way to open an emerging art gallery. That, according to Charlie J, this is the blueprint.
Anything more specific? Else? So what was Badass Gallery number one then?
Well, like if you could work for Regan for a year or two.
But you didn't work for
I
gallery.
No. I did the exact opposite of this. Right. What I'm describing is the
You're giving
way
advice
do.
Of what Charlie James don't, says. Yeah, don't yeah. do what I say. Don't do what
do
I do.
Do not do what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're a rebel then. You're sort of a rebel, aren't you?
Yeah, well, it was a passion project, and it has, you know, it's working, but... yeah, it's definitely, it's funny the stages you go through, you know, and I won't take too long, but you know, when you open it up, you put your name on the door. That was another big, like, whoa, that's fucking awesome. My name, you know, that, like my whole corporate career, I always had like one foot out of the batter's box. And even my academic career, there was always something else I'd rather be doing. You know what I mean? It's like, well, we have to do this. So, you know, I was competitive and I wanted to do good, but I was kind of like, well, you know, like I got to do this. But once you like, call some, you name some business after right. you, and you know, and you do your best. And that was the first awesome thing that happened opening the gallery. It's like you're all in, like, fuck that doing it at the last minute shit, which was everything I did in my academic and corporate career, basically. You know, now it was like, you know, am I doing my best given my resources, time, and expertise? What could I be doing better? You know, like, it was very healthy in that way. But a lot of that good feeling, like all good feelings, I guess, they can burn off under the weight of, you know, financial realities and work and travel and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And the rose-colored glasses do go away. But we're doing things that I'm very proud of now. Like, you know, we're getting a lot more of the program into good museum collections, particularly in the last year. And nothing feels better than that to me. Like, that's, if you look at, like, the circuit of how it's supposed to work, Margie makes the work. He brings it to me. I put it up. We put it in private collections. And we get press, you know, that feeds Margie's bibliography and her CV and everything like that. But hopefully we can even put it in public collections, in museums and stuff, where it achieves this kind of patina of permanence. Like, it should be there forever.
I don't know where we go from there, but maybe that's a good place to end. Is there anything else that you feel like we've left out? I mean, obviously there are 100 things, but
Chinatown's still cool, man. Everything's cool. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an exciting time to be in LA, right? Like, I didn't really consider going to New York to do this project when I was up there at Microsoft and kind of getting like, I got to quit and do something. The burn rate in New York would have been murder. You know, like,
well, your overhead too would have.
That's what I mean. Yeah. The overhead, both personal and professional, would have just been like a bloodbath. You know. So LA was always what it was going to be. And it's the right choice, right? There's a convergence on LA and it's exciting.
So is part of the back of your mind saying, I have nothing to lose sticking around in Chinatown a little bit longer to the point where people come to me rather than me having,
that's what's happening.
Yeah.
But I, you know, like with anything, as I find, as you get older, you know, you have to scrutinize your own impulses and these little things that these things that you say, like, I have to say, well, why am I saying that? Maybe I'm just rationalizing not wanting to move. Cause another thing I find is I get older, I'm like, I don't want to fucking move. That sucks. You know, like, I have an intolerance, my intolerance for things that suck is really high, and it gets higher the older I get. But I, you know, so self-critically, I want to move. I mean, it's worked for other dealers. Other dealers have left it, but it's got to be the right fit. I ain't doubling my overhead to go.
Well, it's worked for some, but you know, it also hasn't worked for all. It is a risk you take when you leave. It can either, and it, the timing does have to be right.
The timing has to be right, and you basically need to. Basically, for me, like, my criteria is kind of high. Like, I need to fall into somebody else's lease, which is locked in fairly low. You know, someone that basically wants out for any, you know, for hopefully the least negative reasons in the world. That's kind of what I'm looking for. And you know, I need to make sure that I'm not, you know, because I think what I'm saying is logical, right? It makes business sense to sit tight with low overhead in a perfect space, and because the business is growing, you know. But you also don't want to, you know, limit how much you can grow, right? I think we would sell more and meet new local clients, which would be great. The more local clients you have, the less you have to travel, the more profitable you're going to be.
Yeah.
And like I said, we're like, it's legitimately like 20-80, like LA versus out of town, or maybe more. I don't even know. Like, we sell off PDFs and JPEGs. This is what we do. And visits, of course. And the more we can, you know, grow our, it would, it's a no-brainer to grow collectors locally. And I'm open to it, but it's got to be right. It's got
your average sale that's through a PDF or a JPEG. Is that collector somebody who has seen that artist's work elsewhere in person?
Yeah, they've read about it or, yeah.
Well, if they've read about it, they haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's true. Like, it's no problem.
So it is speculative.
It's no problem to sell people work that they haven't seen before. None. It's easy. And it's routine, actually. People read about our artists and are like, I'm interested in that career. And it just so happens, like, so we don't do straight painting, right? So one of the laments I have in today's market is that there is an enormous saturation of young genius abstract painters. And I don't see this work as having fuck all to do with anything except money. You know, it's easy to proclaim young abstract painters geniuses because, you know, you don't need an intellectual argument for it. It's abstract painting, right? You can declare it. And that's what people do. This person is unlocked the key.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly. I'm glad you brought that up because it's something that's come up a couple times before. And I think market-wise, they're called geniuses, but not literally called geniuses. They're just hot. They just become hot market-wise. I don't think any of these people have been called geniuses that I know of.
Well, okay, fair play. Anyway, but you understand perfectly what I was trying to communicate, which is what you said.
What you're talking about is the, in some people's minds, out of control market explosion of abstraction.
It's the easiest thing in the world.
With no necessary rationale for it.
Money is the rationale
other than,
for it.
Right.
Well, also, it's not offensive to have that in your
any
home.
Context.
There's, yeah. I mean...
But, so here's... This is actually... I'm glad that we
wait
didn't
a second.
Stop.
Before we continue, do you show any abstract
no.
painters?
Basically,
are
none.
You against abstraction?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I mean, that gets to the question, you know, why do... You know, I ask myself a lot, you know, why do I show what I show, right?
Yeah.
You know, I have that literature background, so there is an element of, you see a lot of text, right? I like work where there are kind of readable multiple levels of conceptual interpretation. That's just how, you know, but I try to stretch myself, of course. But the point, Michael, I think for me is that, this will take just a second, but it'll be cogent. I say this a lot, and then you can tell me what you think. But when I ask myself, what do I show? That's among the most important questions. What should I show?
Mm-hmm.
I think I believe there's a framework to answer that question. And I think if you want to look at ultimately what the utility of fine art is historically and essentially, you need only to look at the organization and the contents of an encyclopedic museum. And I always use the Metropolitan as an example. What is the function and the structure of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City? This is not a point I want to debate, but it's arguably, it's more contemporary than the Louvre or other places. So it's a good example, but it's 5,000 years of human history, right? Organized around civilizational timelines.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Egypt. Here's mm-hmm. Edo, Japan. Here's mm-hmm. Ming, China. All the way up, right? And along these civilizational timelines, there are historically sifted and selected objects, basically, you know, that are deemed necessary for preservation and presentation in perpetuity. Ultimately, if you're very successful, your work will end up being aligned on one of these civilizational timelines at an encyclopedic museum, maybe like the museum, the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. So if that might be true, and it is true, right? I mean, and if you look at how these people are, again, the structure of the collection, ultimately that's going to happen to this period, right? Someone's going to put our time
right.
on a civilizational timeline, and they're going to sift through the objects that have been made that are evidentiary of now. And that is very important. What does the work reflect about the times? How, in what ways was it innovative of work downstream? You know, there are a few qualities, I think, and all this can be debated, but ultimately that's going to happen now. And the history of art is not the history of collecting. So all this wanking over abstract painting, abstract painting has fuck all to do with anything these days. There's a MoMA show, which I view as an apology, that's in the works right now. I think it opens soon, or might have just opened, but anyway. And it's talking about, it's a collection of these hot painters. And they're calling it painting in an atemporal painting in an atemporal world. Atemporal is what they mean by that is artwork that emerges from a period, but has nothing to do with that period. Which is, as I see it, problem with this riot of contemporary abstraction. It has nothing to do with anything. If you look at abstraction in the 50s, it was responding to things that came before it. It was reflecting collective anxiety. There were all these reasons for it to be there. Those reasons are gone outside of simply making, you know, fetish collectible objects, you know, in today's market, as I see it. And that's, you know, it's a strong statement, but that's what I believe. So again, back to front, why do I show what I show? I show work that I believe is reflective and not News at 11 reflective. You know, I don't like fucking topical bummers, you know, like, you don't start going to see George Bush or some Al-Qaeda. You're not going to see like horrible, hard hammer blow political shit at my gallery. But I do believe strongly that the work should in some way evidence the times in which we live. And abstracting to me, it reflects the times in which we live from an impoverishment of ideas perspective and from a kind of gluttonous market perspective, but that's about it. So there'll be a show ultimately of this weird kind of neo-Gilded Age period, right? And maybe Koons at Versailles is the absolute apotheosis of this weird market-driven end of the world, like the end is nigh kind of a period that we're living in. But ultimately, if we're lucky enough to have this period kind of historically sifted and presented in an encyclopedic museum in perpetuity, I don't see how all this fashionable abstraction is going to land. I don't think it has nothing to do with anything. Digital painting or whatever, this new kind of, you know, technology enabled abstraction is to me slightly more interesting actually. But you have people that are just doing retrograde abstraction. And it's a fucking drag.
Well, I was going to ask you.
I hate it. I hate it. I think it's fucking stupid. I literally.
Why such passion?
Like I said, it just does. It doesn't make any sense.
It offends your intellectual sensibility.
It kind of does. It kind of does.
I don't think there's any better place to end than that. Cheers, Charlie. Man. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Michael. Thank
Thanks,
you,
Marge, very much. Thanks, Michael. Charlie.
And
we're out.
Thank you very much again to Charlie. Did that knock your socks off? Indeed. Obviously, we could have a 5.5 hour conversation about abstraction. Stay tuned for, you know, the 200th anniversary episode on that. You can support the show in a number of ways through theconversationpod.com. I did a Kickstarter a year and a half ago now. That was to raise money for equipment to expand from just a crappy single microphone to 3 microphones plus mic stands plus a mixer, which I have. But I would like to add one more mic and mic stand to that set of equipment so that I can have a co-host and 2 guests at the same time. That is the next step in terms of ambition of an episode, and I would very much appreciate your support in that. All told, I would say the expenses of those 2 items are no more than $140, $150, $160 bucks. So if you have not given to the show thus far and you could give, you know, $5, $10, $15, $50, $7,500, you know, $1,000 would be very much appreciated. You can do that safely via a PayPal link on theconversationpod.com. Of course, you can also become a fan on the various social media at Artist Podcast on Facebook, and you can leave a nice review on iTunes. Oh, that's so much begging. What am I offering in exchange? I guess I forgot to mention, if I do get a donation for you and you have a premium that you would like, whether that is, you know, a t-shirt, custom-made t-shirt from one of the people who've been on the show, just a custom-made t-shirt that, that has the Conversation logo on it, or maybe a an object that is mass-producible or pseudo-mass-producible from one of the people been on the show, something along those lines, you know, let us know, and we can get working on that to give you something for your donation rather than just have it be a straight donation. All right? How does that sound? Good? Thank you very much again for being here, for listening to this show. You regulars especially, you are the best, and I appreciate you coming out every episode, or just about every episode. All right, thank you very much to all of you for being here once again, and I will talk to you next Saturday. Ciao for now.